Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Joe Palca reporting. The Secretary of Defense predicts an agreement between the U.S. and Russia. U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter says he expects an agreement in very short order with Russia on air safety above Syria to avoid a potential mid-air accident between U.S. and Russian jets. The Pentagon says Russian and U.S. pilots carrying out separate missions in Syria came within 16 kilometers of each other at one point last week. Also today, militants fired rockets at Russia's embassy in Damascus and what Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov called an act of terror. Israel has suffered its deadliest day since the latest wave of Palestinian attacks began. At least three Israelis were killed Tuesday and more than a dozen wounded in the three Palestinian attacks. The Israeli cabinet has authorized police to seal off troubled areas in Jerusalem. A statement issued by the office of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu today said that the permanent residency rights of terrorists will be revoked and the property of those who carry out attacks will be confiscated. Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says he will travel to Israel and the Palestinian territories due to the escalation of violence there.
Unless we get going, a two-state solution could conceivably be stolen from everybody. And there's been a massive increase in settlements over the course of last years. Now you have this violence because there's a frustration that is growing and a frustration among Israelis who don't see any movement. So I look at that and I say, you know, if that did explode, and I pray and hope it won't, and I think there are options to prevent that, but we would inevitably be, you know, at some point, we're going to have to be engaged in working through those kinds of difficulties.
This is VOA News. The investigation into the crash of Malaysia Airlines flight MH17 over eastern Ukraine last year finds the plane was shot down by a surface-to-air missile fired from a Russian-made missile launcher. Dutch officials announced their findings Tuesday. Charles Maines has more from Moscow for VOA.
Speaking in Moscow, the CEO of Almazante, Yan Novikov, says evidence shows flight MH17 was hit by one of Russia's Buk missile systems, as Western nations have alleged, but that the weapon was an older Soviet model no longer used by the Russian military. Novikov says his company's analysis also indicates the rocket was fired from territory that Russia says was under Ukrainian government control at the time of the crash. The Almazante presentation came just hours before a Dutch safety board issued its long-anticipated report on the downing of flight MH17. While the Dutch investigation does not seek to assign blame for the incident, Russia has chafed at suggestions the Russian-made rocket was fired from rebel-held territory. Charles Maines for VOA News, Moscow.
The report said the plane was hit on the left side by shrapnel from the detonation of a missile fired from the ground. It said the plane broke up immediately while still in the air. European Union observers say that despite logistical problems, Guinea's presidential election on Sunday appeared to be free and fair. The findings are at odds with opposition candidates who say the election was rigged to favor President Alpha Conde. They say the vote should be annulled. Amnesty International is accusing Western-backed Kurdish forces of forcibly ejecting mainly Arab and Turkmen populations from villages in northern Syria that were previously under the control of terror group Islamic State. Henry Ridgewell reports Kurdish forces deny any policy of forced displacement.
All but one of the houses in the village of Husseinia, northern Syria, has been razed to the ground. Husseinia was under the control of Islamic State militants until earlier this year, but they were forced out by Kurdish forces known as the YPG. Amnesty International claims the YPG, along with their police force known as the Asayish, destroyed the village along with at least six others. Amnesty claims thousands of people, mainly ethnic Arabs and Turkmen, have been forced to flee their homes in a campaign of collective punishment. Henry Ridgewell, London.
For more on this story, visit our website at voanews.com. Democratic presidential hopefuls are getting their turn in the spotlight right at this moment as they've taken the stage in Las Vegas for their first debate. Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton leads in the opinion polls with about 40% support, while her chief challenger, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, comes in at 25%. Joe Palca reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barte in Washington. Today's Wednesday, October 14th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. 30,000 South African coal mine workers returned to work today after ending a 10-day strike.
We only managed to get 1,000 in two companies, which is Anglo Coal and Exxaro, where the companies agreed to a 1,000 wage increase for a period of 2 years.
Levuwani Mamburu is acting spokesman for the National Union of Mine Workers in South Africa. Somalia's Al-Shabaab is shifting its strategy as fighters dwindle. DRC's Electoral Commission complains about the lack of funds for the coming general election. And the autopsy of the late iconic Burkina Faso leader Thomas Sankara shows he was killed by several bullets.
We never, up to now, have the feeling of vengeance. No, we just need the normal institution of the country, Burkina Faso, to do the job in terms of justice.
Paul Sankara is the junior brother of the late Burkina Faso President Thomas Sankara. Zimbabwe's government is urged to provide more funds for the country's crumbling health sector. And fuel shortage in South Sudan's capital is making life more difficult for residents. Those stories plus Mark Omar Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. South Africa, more than 30,000 members of the National Union of Mine Workers are returning to work this morning after they voted Tuesday to end their 10-day strike, which began when wage negotiations broke down. The strike affected mine giants like Anglo American, Exxaro, and Glencore, threatening the supply of coal to power plants. Levuwani Mamburu, acting spokesman for the Mine Workers Union, says the members decided to end their strike after accepting partial revised offers of wage increases.
What we can confirm to you as the National Union of Mine Workers is that the coal strike in South Africa has ended. We had signed the agreement with the Chamber of Mines after we got the mandate from our members who gave us a go-ahead to sign the agreement.
Now, does that mean that you have what you wanted? You wanted some increases. Do you have that?
Yes. Remember initially when we started these negotiations on the 22nd of June, we were demanding 3,000 rand for the lowest category and 14% for the artisan miners and officials. So when we signed the agreement, the NUM was demanding 1,000 for the lowest category and then still 14% for the artisan miners and officials. But we only managed to get 1,000 in two companies, which is Anglo Coal and Exxaro, where the companies agreed to a 1,000 wage increase for a period of 2 years. A company like Glencore has only agreed for 800 to 895 for a two-year period, whereas the other small companies only agreed for 750 wage increases for a period of 2 years.
So when do you return to work? When do you start work again?
Our members started to return to work tonight at 6 p.m. The others will be returning to work tomorrow morning.
Was there any government intervention? I mean, how was this settled?
No, there was no government intervention. It was the NUM negotiating team that negotiated with the chamber until they reached the agreement. So the government was not involved. The only thing that I saw is the Department of Mineral Resources in South Africa did release a statement to say that they welcome the signing of the agreement in the coal sector.
There were some who felt that perhaps strike is not a good thing, but do you feel now your members got something out of going on strike?
You know, one thing that we need to put it clear is that a strike is the last option or is the only weapon that our members have. Our members were not interested to go on strike, but because we could not agree with the chamber at that particular moment, they were forced to go on strike. So the strike is the only weapon that our members have to exercise their rights.
Levuwani Mamburu is acting spokesman for the National Union of Mine Workers of South Africa. He was speaking with me from Soweto in Johannesburg. A family member of the late iconic Burkina Faso President Thomas Sankara says the family does not want vengeance, but rather justice for his untimely death. Sankara was assassinated in 1987 in a military coup. His body and those of 12 former aides were exhumed earlier this year for an autopsy to determine how they died. Now, Sankara family lawyers said on Tuesday that the autopsy shows he was killed by many bullets during the coup d'etat led by now former President Blaise Compaoré. Sankara's death certificate stated at the time that the 37-year-old former captain died of natural causes. Paul Sankara, younger brother of the late Thomas Sankara, says the autopsy confirms what the family knew all along, that Thomas Sankara was assassinated.
The autopsy has been done and the ballistic, but the DNA is not completed yet. So still waiting for the final conclusions of the scientific forensic work by the commissions and the justice.
Paul, I mean, it's been 30 years since Thomas Sankara, your brother, was assassinated. The autopsy is saying that perhaps he was riddled with bullets. How does that make you feel?
That's sadness. But at the same time, no way I couldn't think that a member of our family, Thomas Sankara, died for natural causes, as they noticed and the so-called death certificate that I gave our sister-in-law, Thomas Sankara's widow, in 1989, I guess. So the first feeling is the satisfaction in terms of justice. We never, up to now, have the feeling of vengeance. No, we just need the regular, normal institution of the country, Burkina Faso, to do the job in terms of justice. Once again, no vengeance, but somebody has to respond and say what has been done to Thomas Sankara and why.
Do you think the search for justice should also involve the former president, Blaise Compaoré?
Due to the tight and deep and long-term link, it would surprise me that Gilbert Gengue, if considered guilty by the justice in Burkina Faso, Blaise Compaoré, his mentor, former president, will be free and... Yes, both are responsible of economic and, most importantly, bloody crime done inside and outside Burkina Faso. So, yes, Blaise Compaoré and Gilbert Gengue is like two faces of the same coin. So, yeah. Definitely, Gilbert Gengue and Blaise Compaoré has to be bringing it to the trial with evidence. And the people of Burkina Faso need to hear them about different bad issues, conflicts and you know, cases that they obviously are responsible for it.
You said that you want justice, no revenge. In the name of reconciliation, are you willing to say let bygones be bygones?
Yes, you know, everywhere that Reconciliation Commission has been set up and was a success at the end, most of the time when we talk about African continent and in terms of reconciliation, one of the good examples is in South Africa. I don't have the details, but at least you have three steps: the truth, justice, and then work hard for the reconciliation and forgiveness for those who talk about it. But you can't just come and say, okay, let's wipe everything that has been done, and then, okay, we're sorry about it. No, we need the truth. Once again, and justice, families that has members killed by any regime can come. Those who are responsible will maybe we'll get a reconciliation with her. But at the end, we need reconciliation, but not at any price, any cost. It has to be a scientific, institutional process in order to get to the reconciliation, not just blindly and that's a fake and it won't last.
Paul Sankara is the junior brother of the late Burkina Faso President Thomas Sankara. He was speaking with me from Washington, D.C. A leaked letter from the Democratic Republic of Congo's Electoral Commission says the commission has not received the funding it was promised for upcoming elections, holding up preparations for the vote. As Nick Long reports from Goma in eastern Congo, the news came the day after the commission's president resigned.
The Electoral Commission, known here as the CENI, was reacting to a statement by a government minister who said the CENI has enough funds to do its job of preparing for national, provincial and local elections between now and the end of next year. Hans Hobecker, an analyst for the International Crisis Group, follows the DRC's electoral process. He says the CENI wrote a letter to the government saying that since 2013 it has received only 17% of the budget it was allocated. Government spokesman Lambert Mende declined to comment on the figures. But Mende did say that the budget approved by Parliament for the CENI of more than $1 billion seems excessive for a country with a total budget of only $8 billion and was based on the assumption that external donors would help pay, which they now seem reluctant to do. Hoebecker described the budget as monumental. He says they could do the job for a lot less, and both the budgeting and the whole electoral process are far from transparent. Hoebecker told VOA he visited the CENI's offices in Katanga province recently and saw a risk of enormous waste. He says equipment and material that he saw are dilapidated, and they have vehicles that haven't been used since 2011. He says he's heard that ballot boxes from the last election are now widely used as rubbish bins. The letter from CENI's staff casts more doubt over the DRC's election process. The process already suffered a blow in the past week when the chief of the Electoral Commission resigned, citing health reasons. Opponents of President Joseph Kabila have expressed concern he wants to postpone next year's presidential vote in hopes of staying in office beyond his second term. Nick Long for VOA News, Goma.
Today's Wednesday, October 14th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Let's give a shout-out to listeners on our affiliate station, Brila FM in Nigeria, and Radio Lake Victoria in Kisumu, Kenya. Daybreak Africa time is 16 minutes past the hour. As it loses ground in Somalia, the militant group Al-Shabaab has increasingly turned to attacks which use a few fighters to make an impact. The biggest of these, such as the assault on Garissa University in northeastern Kenya in April, have left dozens of people dead. The group is now calling on Muslim youth in East Africa to take up this strategy. Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
In a 21-minute video sermon, a man in a black uniform surrounded by about 50 Swahili-speaking fighters acknowledges the dwindling number of fighters within Al-Shabaab. But the man in the video, Ahmed Iman Ali, a Kenyan Al-Shabaab leader, had a message. He says, how many times have we heard of operations carried out by three or four brothers in Mogadishu that have defeated troops from different countries that are also receiving assistance from Western nations? A few boys, four, six, can go in. They're able to take up a camp. It is not clear if he's referring to a specific attack. In June, Al-Shabaab claimed responsibility for an attack on a military compound in Mogadishu, where Somali intelligence officials train. Militants also attacked a camp for Burundian AU troops in southern Somalia, killing 30 soldiers. Independent analyst Abdul Habshek Abdi Samad says this new video appears aimed at disillusioned youth.
The guy is going to boost the morale of the fighters. And in fact, he admitted they lost the ground. So they lost even some fighters on the operation. So now he says that still he's going to build the morale of the fighters. He's just telling them, be patient. Victory is near. We will overcome all these problems sooner than later.
Head of the Terrorism Research and Analysis Consortium, Jasmine Opperman, disagrees.
What we are seeing here is an Al-Shabaab in a much stronger position as previously. If one looks at the video and the person talking, we see a person relaxed. We see fighters in a good spirit. We see a message of patience being conveyed as if Al-Shabaab is in full control, knows what it is going to do, what it is doing, and is under no threat.
Kenyan security forces recently launched an offensive to clear Al-Shabaab from Kenya's Borno forest, which stretches into Somalia. The Kenyan Shabaab commander says they are prepared for a long battle. He says they know we are inside Kenya. They know the forest we are in. Let them come in with their weapons in the forest. Whoever comes out alive is the victor. That is a challenge I'm giving them. The Al-Qaeda-linked militant group is fighting to overthrow the internationally-backed government in Mogadishu. The government is protected by a force of 22,000 troops from Kenya, Ethiopia, Burundi, Uganda and Djibouti. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Zimbabwe's health officials and civil society organizations told lawmakers on Tuesday to lobby the government to put more money in its 2016 budget for the country's crumbling health sector. They said Zimbabwe faces imminent disaster if donors, who are currently providing more than 80% of the funds required to run the healthcare system in the country, pull out. Erwin Chifera has more from Harare.
Health and Child Welfare Permanent Secretary Dr. Gerald Gwinji told Parliament's Health Portfolio Committee during a 2016 budget consultation that he is worried government support for health had been declining over the years, leaving donors to bear the brunt.
Highlight that we are not growing from government resources. Any growth that we've had really is from partner funding. And if that is withdrawn, it's a major disaster in the country. And we think we should invest more in our health in order to avert that.
He said the ministry is worried by low staffing levels in hospitals and clinics, service provision and drug supplies in the country. Inji said he is not expecting much changes in terms of budget allocations given the country's low revenues and depressed economy. The ministry expects salaries to chew $273 million, with $11 million being needed for capital expenditure and $29 million for operations. The Zimbabwe Association of Church-Related Hospitals Executive Director, Vuyelwa Sidile Chitimbire, told the committee it's worrying that the government no longer prioritized healthcare funding. She also lamented the lack of funding to deal with the time bomb that is presented by non-communicable diseases such as diabetes, high blood pressure, and cancer.
The government should, one, support commitments to progressively move towards a target of 5% of the GDP spent on government health expenditure, and also to try and reach at least $86 government spending per capita.
Community Working Group on Health Director Itai Rusike said the government should do all it can to increase staffing levels in public hospitals, which he said were last reviewed in the 1980s.
So it means we need to review the staff establishment, because the current one that we are using is now outdated, given the burden of disease that we are now grappling with in the country.
Zimbabwe Medical Association President Dr. Agnes Mahomba told lawmakers to ensure Treasury adequately funded public health hospitals so that the majority of the population can access health services. She said private institutions were now overcrowded as service delivery had deteriorated in public health facilities. This year, the health ministry wanted $303 million for operations, but was given only $53 million, with donors providing $147 million to fund the sector. Reporting from Harare, this is Ivan Chifera.
Residents of South Sudan's capital, Juba, say a fuel shortage is making their lives more difficult and very expensive. Many workers have had to walk to their offices or use alternative forms of transportation, many of which have been paralyzed for the last 2 weeks because of the fuel shortage. Philipton Aleo reports from Juba on the impact of the fuel crisis.
Charles Koch lives in the western Juba suburb of Gudele. He works at a private office in downtown Juba, 5 kilometers away from his home. He says since the fuel shortages began 2 weeks ago, he has often had to walk to work.
I came to the office very late. I will not be able to run to get, like, if I need something somewhere, nothing will take me quickly. So everything now is affected by this crisis of fuel.
Koi says fuel is hard to find through official suppliers like gas stations, and on the small amount he makes each month, he cannot afford to buy fuel on the black market. He says 1.5 liters of gasoline costs 10 times more today than it did 2 weeks ago.
Imagine this bottle, the Crystal now, the so-called Crystal, is 150. Jerkins of benzene, petrol, is 1,400. Only 20 liters, 1,400. So we have to garage all the cars at home, then we use barbara. Even barbara has now become more expensive.
Koi says that because border operators have increased what they charge, he is now paying 46 Sudanese pounds to go to the office in the morning and return home in the evening. Daniel Mayen has also felt the fuel price hikes. For the last 4 days, he has been walking the 6 kilometers each way from his home in Shirkat to the bank where he works. His commute used to take 20 to 30 minutes by car. But since the fuel shortages began around 2 weeks ago, he has had to walk to work, and the walk takes him up to 1.5 hours. Mayan says he is expected to be at work at 8 o'clock in the morning.
But it takes me some time, even up to 9, 10, to reach the office. And also it has been hard to get taxis. Even if you get it, you also struggle to fight to get yourself inside the car. So it becomes so hard.
Joseph Chilito is the managing director of the Nile Petroleum, the government-owned entity that is responsible for supplying petrol stations in Juba with fuel. Clinton says the fuel strategy is not the government's fault, but it stems from a supply problem in the country from which most of the fuel that is used in Juba is imported.
There is no petrol there in Kenya, and it is not our problem here in South Sudan, but it is a regional problem. All five countries that used to get petrol from Eldoret are now dry, but we managed to get a number of trucks are on their ways now. Until tomorrow, we'll have 20 trucks of petrol, and it will normalize the situation.
Clinton says new measures, including steep fines, are being put in place to avoid fuel being sold to dealers who end up selling it on the black market. Even though South Sudan is a major oil producer, it does not refine its own oil and has to import from neighboring countries. For BOA News, I am Philip Thonaleu in Juba.
Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Wednesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. Namibia's Brave Warriors came from behind to edge Gambia 2-1 in the return leg of the Africa Preliminary 2018 FIFA World Cup qualifier in Windhoek on Tuesday. The Brave Warriors advanced on a 3-2 aggregate. Madagascar and Central African Republic drew 2-2 in Antananarivo. Madagascar win 5-2 on aggregate. Burundi beat Seychelles 2-0 in Bujumbura to advance on a 3-0 aggregate. Sierra Leone pipped Chad 2-1. In Port Harcourt, River State, Nigeria. However, with an aggregate of 2-2, Chad carried the day on their away goal rule. Comoro Islands also cashed in on their away goal advantage following their 1-1 draw with Lesotho in Maseru. Elsewhere, Botswana outwitted Eritrea 3-1 in Francistown to prevail with a 5-1 scoreline. Niger outclassed Somalia 4-0 in Niamey to win the tie 6-0 on aggregate. Liberia dismissed their hosts Guinea-Bissau 3-1 in Bissau to progress on a 4-2 aggregate. Mauritania overpowered South Sudan 4-0 to advance courtesy of a 5-1 aggregate. The tie between Swaziland and Djibouti in Lobambo will be replayed after the match was abandoned. Meanwhile, the Republic of Congo edged Benin 2-1 in Brazzaville as Algeria pipped Senegal by a solitary goal in Algiers in friendlies played on Tuesday. In kickboxing, Australia's Piotr Lagodzki is the new World Kickboxing Federation Intercontinental Welterweight Champion following his fifth round technical knockout of Ugandan defending champion Umar Semata in Kampala, Uganda on Sunday. Finally, in athletics, Tanzanian defending champions Dixon Marwa and Anastasia Range line up to defend their men's and women's crown at the Rotary Half Marathon in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania today, Wednesday. They face a field of challenges drawn from Burundi, Ethiopia, Kenya, Malawi, Mozambique, Namibia, Rwanda, South Africa and Tanzania. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. A lawyer for the family of Burkina Faso's late Marxist revolutionary leader Thomas Sankara says an autopsy on his remains proves he was the victim of a vicious assassination in 1987. The attorney says Sankara was killed by at least 10 gunshots to the head and legs and thrown into a grave with 12 others. European Union observers say that despite logistical problems, Guinea's presidential election on Sunday appeared to be free and fair. The comments Tuesday from the EU observer team and its chief, Frank Engo, are at odds with opposition candidates who say the election was rigged to favor President Alpha Condé and should be annulled. And that's it for this Wednesday, October 14th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Tracy Carter, and reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, as well as post editor Mark Ullman, along with our engineer Jamie Cook, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very, very good Wednesday.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga. Please join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 1700 hours UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests to share their ideas and enlighten us all on the topic at hand. So please plan to be with us every Thursday at 1700 hours UTC on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America.